This is the Brooklyn Culture Jam. I'm your host, Dan Kinch. Tonight, we will be talking to Atik Zabinski and Kelly Stewart. They are working on a documentary for the Kimani Gray case. We'll have them in studio right now. Thanks for joining us. And are you there?
Yes, we're here. Hi.
Okay. Let me read my intro, and I'll make sure that I get it right. On March 9th, 2013, 16-year-old Kimani Kiki Gray was shot dead by plainclothes police officers in East Flatbush, Brooklyn. The police claimed the youth had pulled a gun on them and quickly released his arrest records to the public. But his supporters and friends in the community had a very different story to tell about this young man's life. And you're working on a documentary on the film that, on the questions that still surround his death. So introduce yourselves.
I'm Atik Zabinski.
I'm Kelly Stewart.
Okay, so let's talk. I read something that's basically on your website. Have I gotten any of the details wrong? Do you want to lay this out for my listeners?
That's all correct.
So lay this out a little more for my listeners who might not understand some of the politics about this question.
Well, the two police officers who killed Kimani Gray were in plain clothes. And while we may not know exactly what led up to their shooting Kimani Gray, we do know that they threatened witnesses on the scene, telling them to leave the area. They pointed a gun at a witness who was watching from her window and told her to stick her head back in the window. And later, they rationalized their killing by saying that Kimani Gray had pointed a gun at them. Witnesses, in spite of the intimidation by the police, did come forward to the media later and say that they saw his hands and that he was unarmed. And the police have yet to release to the public any photograph of this alleged weapon other than a shot of a gun in a cardboard box. In other words, no photograph apparently was taken at the scene of the crime, which is highly irregular. This same precinct, the 67th Precinct, is now the subject of an investigation concerning planted evidence. Not the same officers who killed Kimani Gray, but other officers in the same precinct. There's been a distinct pattern of repeated setting up people with planted guns. Yet despite all of this, the DA of Brooklyn, Ken Thompson, has refused to bring Kimani Gray's case to a grand jury.
Now, there was a whole spate of cases that came up in the last few years. Of course, Eric Garner, everyone's heard of, and then there's Romali Graham and then Kimani. Is this a function, do you think, of better police coverage? In other words, for instance, Eric Garner was videotaped when he was assaulted by the Staten Island police, or is this always something that's been around and we're aware of it now more because there's more media coverage?
I think it's something that's always been around and just there's more media coverage and also more cameras, and groups like Cop Watch and other activist community groups are helping to make us aware of it.
At the same time, though, there's definitely an increased militarization of police forces around the country, and it does seem that there is an epidemic of police violence, an upstepping of violence and conflict around the country.
But now, I was talking to you earlier, and I've been in New York way too long to remember, and the first button I bought was one to ask for justice for Eleanor Bumpers and Michael Stewart. So this is not a new problem with the NYPD.
No, it certainly isn't.
So one of the things that was being discussed was the idea of body cameras. Do you think that would have changed this case at all?
The problem with body cameras is who's going to control when the camera is turned on and who's going to control that footage and what happens to that footage. And I think it's much more useful to have citizens trained to have cameras than to have body cameras.
Yeah, there's already been a number of cases of dashboard cameras and body cams being turned off just at crucial moments, or footage mysteriously going missing. So it really it doesn't help to all these measures to have the police themselves don't work.
Now, but policing themselves, wasn't that part of the settlement over the stop and frisk case? Or am I getting that wrong?
There were limitations put on stop and frisk, and there is an independent investigator that's been assigned, but I'm not sure. It's rather toothless.
Okay. Would you agree with that, Atik?
I just don't remember the details of the outcome of that whole thing well enough to comment.
I mean, I think one problem with, for instance, in this case, in Kamani's case, we heard that there was video, that a neighbor had video, and that neighbor happens to work for the corrections department. This is what the other neighborhood people have told us. And that video has disappeared. And so in any case where there's video that would shed light on what the police actually did, often that video just disappears. So I don't have faith that body cameras would be any different.
Yeah, Chantel Davis comes to mind. Lots of people had their cameras confiscated by the police for evidence when she was murdered in East Flatbush. And people are still awaiting the return of their cameras, their personal property. What's happened to all that footage? It's been, what, 2 years now? More than 2 years.
I think one more thing. Tashana King, who was the witness who saw the shooting, and she had video of moments after, and she recorded how long it took for the ambulance to come and how the police blocked the ambulance and would not let them take Kamani away. So he basically
bled to death
there while he was pleading for his life. She said not only was she threatened with the F word and put your head back in the window or I'll blow your head off, basically, they told her. But then no one wanted to hear her story. And they didn't turn her information over to the DA until, I think 2 weeks later.
How does all this fit in? I know that the Black Lives Matter movement is now covering the case. The criminal cases being made against Ramzi Orta, for instance. So you have someone who's actually videotaping police misconduct who's actually the only one indicted in that particular matter.
Exactly. Right. I mean, it's very common for the police to target anyone who's recording them. And Cop Watch and some of these other groups have stressed how you can't have just one person recording. You have to have like a team of people recording so you can record what happens to the people who are recording.
So let's switch gears a little bit. You are here because you were working on a documentary about this case. Talk to me about, you know, the germination of that idea.
Well, I had been doing video work as an activist for, I guess, a year and a half, around the time that Kamani was killed. And I heard about the uprising in his neighborhood where hundreds of youth came out to protest his slaying and the tarnishing of his name in the media. And I shot videos of conflicts between protesters and police, and I uploaded them and had the usual disappointment to find that people aren't really informed by this sort of thing. They sort of take sides based on their preconceptions. And someone, maybe it was me, said it would take a documentary to really shed light on what's going on here. And that was the beginning of it. I was at the point of getting ready to leave the activism thing behind me and sort of get my quote-unquote life back together again. And this presented itself, and I didn't feel right with moving on just yet, especially as this young man was not even allowed to continue his life in any way at all.
Kelly, what brought you into this?
I had been doing a project photographing vigils of people who had been killed by the police. There's a lot of them. And I met Atik at the Marley Graham, a press conference for Marley Graham. And so then I asked I could be involved in the Kamani project. And so through that, like, not only Kamani's story, but I've come to know so many people that have had the same situation happen to them, so many mothers and one of the things about Kamani's killing is it didn't just kill him, it destroyed so many people, his family, his friends, his community, his schoolmates, his teacher. It just has such a huge impact. And maybe we could talk a little bit about the demonization of Kamani.
Yeah. We should also mention we have another collaborator who isn't with us tonight, Raven Rakia, who's been with the project from almost day one, maybe day seven.
Yes, and I'm suddenly blocking the name of the film that you're doing is...
Defended in the Streets.
Right.
And our website is defendedinthestreets.com or kamanifilm.com.
Now let's jump back to what Kelly was talking about in terms of the demonization of Kamani, because as I was reading about this, it seems that death is not the worst thing that can happen in many cases.
Yes. In Kamani's case, the police, to give credence to their story, that he had a gun, brought forward all of his arrest history, and when his friends rose up and staged protests, they took it a step further and portrayed him as a gang member by going to his Facebook page and finding photos of him putting up alleged gang signs. So this is...
We talked to a lot of his friends because it's this charge that's leveled against people who are killed by the police, especially young people, like he was in a gang. As if that justifies a state killing without any trial, without anything, and B, a lot of groups of kids hanging out, making some sign, doesn't mean they're in a gang or doing anything. These kids are just, they're teenagers and they're children.
Do you think there's also, I mean, obviously New York, the NYPD, does it have a cultural problem? I know that one of the issues that was argued in the Eric Garner case is that you have white suburban officers essentially acting as an army of occupation here in New York.
Yes, just come out to Kamani's neighborhood, East Flatbush, the 50s, and look at the police. I mean, look at the neighborhood. Almost everybody in that neighborhood is black, Caribbean. And the police officers, they're mostly white. Not all, but mostly. It's a real, the disparity is really obvious.
There's also a policy of the NYPD to put rookies in this neighborhood. I don't know, I think Bratton said they were going to change that, but they put people who are out of their depth, don't know how to talk to people, and they're scared. We were at one vigil, and the police did some really provocative things and caused a lot of tension, and things almost exploded. And then later, I was walking down the street, and I was talking to this woman in the neighborhood, and she said she had heard the police saying, "We're scared." Like, they're literally scared of the people who they're supposed to be protecting. And that's, of course, as we know, a huge problem that leads to people being killed.
So there's all kinds of problems with the cultural problems with the police. There's the racism. There's the whole blue wall of silence mentality where all vestiges of a good cop, bad cop disappear because every cop is going to defend every other cop regardless of whether they're wrong or right.
Right. You mentioned the fear factor. Do you think that had a lot to do with the death of Akai Gurley?
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
So let's talk about that for a moment. You don't mind me pulling you off topic a little bit. I mean, Akai Gurley was killed because a police officer...
We're afraid of the dark. And
right.
The dark people that might be in it. That's what it comes down to. Why would you be walking up a staircase? You're not even chasing anyone. You're just investigating, patrolling. Why would you do that with a gun drawn in your hand?
With your finger on the trigger.
With your finger on the trigger.
How can you, why would you do that? It's true. It's just fear of the people who live there.
Combined with a complete disregard for what might happen. A sense that your life is more important than the lives of anyone else who might be in that staircase. Simply because they're not police.
And you also, as you pointed out, rookie cops tend to be the ones assigned to these kinds of duties, right?
Yes.
They don't want the 50-somethings climbing up and down the stairs.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that they, why should you have police patrolling in this way? I think it's a very loaded situation.
loaded in terms of
more than one.
an accident waiting to happen, in other words.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the Akai Gurley case was very similar to Nicholas Hayward Jr.'s case, where, you know, that was a 13-year-old boy playing on the roof in a housing project, and the police saw him, thought he had a gun, he had a toy gun, and killed him. And I think that's not the only case, but nothing ever happened. There was no justice. There was no case against the officer.
So when you're putting this together as a documentary, what are the things that you need to do besides, obviously, find the equipment and find people to work for you? I mean, what are the pieces you need to assemble in terms of the presentation?
I mean, one thing, it's the actual documentary. It's like a long process of gaining trust in the community and finding the story of the killing and finding other points of view. And
it's mostly been finding the people to talk to and having them take the time and the trust involved to sit down and speak with you on camera. A big part of the film is exploring who Kimani really was and what the impact of a death like this is on a community. So to do that, it really has taken people who knew him well, his friends, his family, to talk with us. And it has taken a long time to gain the community's trust. After the mainstream media had come to that neighborhood and talked to people about Kimani and then went out with stories about him being a gangster, you can imagine these people were not thrilled to see more folks coming to the neighborhood with cameras in their hands.
Well, what kind of credibility do you bring to the table then? What is it that gains the trust of a community when you're going in to do something like this? And I realize this is kind of the first time you've done this, I'm assuming.
Go ahead. I would just say being there, being at every vigil, and being a consistent presence and talking to people. And Atiq has really been there from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's mostly just been consistently showing up. It's been showing up and it's been showing respect, you know. Mainstream media, when they go in for an interview, they're ruthless. Their sympathy is very phony most of the time, you can tell. And they have no sense of the grieving process that a person goes through when they've been deprived this way. I let Carol know. That's Kimani's mother. I let her know about this film right from the get-go, and she gave it her approval, but she wasn't ready to talk to me, and I gave her as much time as she needed until she was completely ready. And that is what it has taken to get the really valuable, truthful moments that have come out in these interviews.
Now, in our discussions beforehand, we were talking about the timing of Kimani's death as opposed to Eric Garner. Do you think that the Eric Garner case, by definition, brought much more interest to both Kimani's death and the death of Marley Graham?
I hope so. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that.
I think every time there's a high-profile police shooting like this, it reminds people of all the other ones that they can remember, the ones they haven't forgotten.
I think the problem is there's so many.
And that's another problem. There's just so many, is that it's the energy it takes to protest everything there is to protest is really hard for anyone to maintain. Eric Garner was definitely a big eye-opener for a lot of people, I think, just because the video was there, so graphic, so unmistakable. And that no justice could come from it just shows how difficult, if not impossible, it is to get justice in a police shooting or slaying.
And do you think, well, there's been a lot of debate back and forth about whether the change of a new mayor and a new police commissioner has made a great deal of difference, and yet right off the bat we had the Eric Garner case. Do you think things would have been different for Kimani Gray if, say, de Blasio had been mayor at the time instead of Michael Bloomberg?
Well, I can't really see how. I laugh every time people talk about the new police commissioner because I was in New York long enough to remember Bratton before. It's the same old to me. De Blasio, I'm not sure what to think of him, but he's definitely trying to play both sides of the aisle here. And
I mean, he's budgeting more for more police officers, and he seems to be ramping up the broken windows policy, which to me, it's broken windows is just another incarnation of stop and frisk, really. It's the same.
Yeah, back up and describe broken windows policy, because not everybody who's listening is going to be familiar with it as we are.
So broken windows is the prosecution of, what's it called,
quality of life crimes.
So someone who puts their feet up on the subway seats gets a ticket. Someone who goes through a turnstile without swiping will get arrested. Marijuana arrests. Open container is a big one. So you have, you know, something that they suspect has alcohol, and they can arrest people without really much cause, just saying quality of life crimes.
The idea behind it is that the police can prevent larger, worse crimes from happening by sort of having a zero tolerance policy towards minor crimes, theoretically. But we know that all these things are practiced in a racist way, that, you know, a cop isn't going to see the same kind of crime being committed if it's being committed by a white person, a black person. And we know that these policies just result in a lot of people getting criminalized, beginning to get criminal records, going into the system, and having a hard time staying out of it.
Now, as you've been working on this film, obviously these things keep occurring. Do they change what you're doing in terms of what has already happened with Kamani Gray? In other words, how do you address the things that we find out about, for instance, the settlement for Romarley Graham? How do you address that in your film? Will you address that in your film?
Well, Kamani's mother, Carol, has been in close contact with other bereaved families, including Romarley Graham's parents. And they do appear in our footage quite a bit, because they've come out to support Carol, and Carol has gone to support some of their events, too. And definitely, she very much reacted when Officer Richard Haste was not indicted for the murder of Romarley Graham. Her own faith in the system went way down. So we definitely explore when things like that happen. How Carol is affected by the failure to get justice in this case, Trayvon Martin's case. As for the settlement, well, I don't know. I actually haven't even spoken to Carol about that settlement. Carol is, of course, is planning her own civil lawsuit against the city. This is basically all that remains for a family to do when they can't get justice. But she's got very little enthusiasm for it. She will be the first to tell you that it's not going to do her any good to get as much all the money in the world. It's not going to bring her son back.
Yeah, people think that a settlement can bring some feeling of, I don't know, something of justice. But all the parents that we've talked to who've lost children, settlement is nothing. It's a very small thing. But it is the only thing that at that point that you can get in any kind of acknowledgement, even though the city doesn't even acknowledge guilt.
And yet, we were talking before we started about the fact that there's what was the figure you quoted, Atik, $500 million in settlements?
Over the course of 5 years, New York City paid close to $500 million.
In settlements for police misconduct. And in fact, one thing I forgot we should say is that the two officers who killed Kamani, the city had already paid $30,000 in settlements for violations that they had committed. And Officer Giovanni Cordova had shot a young boy who survived. The bullet went through his chin. And he was given an award for that. And so actually, when there's violence by police against people, they wind up being promoted and awarded.
But couldn't the case be made? I mean, if police are not being prosecuted or even relieved of duty, fired, whatever, when these incidents happen, couldn't one make the argument that what they're doing is exactly what their bosses want?
Definitely. Definitely they are.
Mm-hmm. So how does that, we can certainly talk about this civil lawsuit problem, but how does that get changed? How do we bring in a leadership that's going to actually pay attention to the rights of people?
However it comes in, it can't come in until enough people notice the problem and care about it. And I'm afraid that right now there's just too many white people in this country who just don't think that this is their problem because it's not happening to white people.
I also think in New York City, this over-policing, militarization of these regions, it's part of gentrification too, perhaps. So the forces behind this that are funding this are real estate interests. Like the mayor has a mandate from people who funded his campaign. And a lot of us voted for this mayor because we thought he was going to change the policing. But he had a lot more campaign money from people who obviously didn't want that to happen.
So you're basically giving up on de Blasio, or do you think there's some kind of public pressure that can be brought to bear? Or
definitely pressure has to be brought to bear, but I don't have any faith in de Blasio.
Yeah, I mean, politicians always require pressure from the outside. They, because they're always under pressure from somewhere or another. If it's not out in the open, it's under the table. So they're going to go wherever the current is strongest. That's just the nature of the game.
I mean, a lot of the city council members that I respected and had huge faith in really disappointed me too, as they're voting to increase the amount of police that we're going to have.
Okay, we're coming close to an end. What I want to do is let you talk about the process of raising the funds to get this picture made and talk to people about how they can get in touch with you, how they can follow what you're doing.
Well, we haven't really started any serious fundraising yet because we're just, you know, there's not many of us and we have a lot of work to do just making the film, but we are starting to look into it. What it's going to take is not just money. It's going to take people petitioning theaters. There's a website for this purpose. It's going to take individual people putting the word out there that this film is something that should be brought to the theaters, that they would go and watch it in the theaters, that they would tell their friends about it. So we're reaching out to the community here and saying, even if you don't have money to contribute to this effort, we definitely could use your help. And the best way to let us know that you'd like to help is to go to our website and sign up for our mailing list.
And your website is?
KamaniFilm.com or DefendedInTheStreets.com. And we really don't send out a lot of emails. I think we've sent out two in the last year. We don't give away email addresses, anything like that.
Well, thank you very much for being here. I wish you the best of luck with this project.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Good luck in getting this finished.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Brooklyn Culture Jammers Radio. This is Dan Kinch. Thanks for joining us. We will be here next week, 8 o'clock. And if you want to get in touch with us, bkculturejammers.com. My website is Brooklyn Culture Jammers, www.brooklynculturejammers.com. We always have something going on that you should hear about. So thanks for joining us.